I next met with Dr. Dirk Schadendorf, and to begin, we chatted about BRAF inhibitors, and specifically the dermatologic side effects of vemurafenib.
One of the main issues with vemurafenib is photosensitivity. Photosensitivity is definitely an issue in several parts of the country. And actually, not only direct sunlight is causing this photosensitivity, but also UVA light, which is when you sit in your car driving with closed windows, this UV irradiation, which is penetrating the glass, is sufficient to cause this photosensitivity, which is happening in almost 40 to 50% of the patients in some degree. So patient education is very critical for vemurafenib to prevent this photosensitivity.
So the people get sunburns?
Yes.
And for practical purpose, what exactly do you tell them?
I mean, people have to take attention that they are not exposed to sun. They have to take sun blockers. So SPF 50 we would recommend. And if possible, to avoid to go and to expose yourself to the sun, which is quite difficult if you think that now some of the patients are on treatment for not only months, but some of our patients are for 2 years, for 3 years on treatment. So it's definitely some issue with quality of life we have to think about. And that's actually one of the major differences. Dabrafenib has only a photosensitivity potential which seemed to be tenfold lower, which I think is worth to consider in areas with high sun exposure. I think one additional part which should be mentioned is rash. So I think BRAF inhibitors will create some rash, and there is almost no difference between vemurafenib and dabrafenib. There is also one issue that new epithelial skin cancers like squamous cell carcinomas can appear and can be induced by the drug itself in around 7% to 20% of the patients, particularly in areas of previous sun exposure. So there seems to be pre-existing neoplastic lesion, which is then stimulated by what we call a paradoxical activation of the pathway, leading to a stimulation of these pre-malignant cells, leading to a development of squamous cell carcinomas of the skin.
So you've got a fantastic review article that's just been published in actually a German journal I'm not even familiar with, Journal of Deutsche Dermatology.
Yes, indeed, that's the Journal of German National Academy. It's published in English, so it's easy to read and to reference.
The thing that I like, you've got these great pictures, and just sort of following what you're just saying, you ought to try to get this published in a journal in the U.S. too. This is fantastic stuff. I haven't seen these photos are really amazing that you put in here. First, phototoxic reaction of the hands after sunlight exposure. That looks pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah, and indeed, this was one of our first patients, actually an older lady. She's now for 26 months on treatment and still having a benefit from it. But on her first May weekend on treatment, she went to the sea, you know, not realizing what kind of drug she is taking. And actually, at that point, we had not so much experience with the drug, maybe not educating her enough. And she got burned just by walking for half an hour at the seaside.
Wow. And then you've also got a photo of hyperkeratosis of the areola.
Yes.
How does that happen?
So the exact mode of action is unclear. So some of the patients are feeling, you know, there is some changing things on the skin. They are worried. I think that's no reason to be anxious about. I think it's just an hyperproliferative area because of the mechanical irritation of the nipple. And you can take very easily care of by using some moisturizing ointment.
You also have an interesting photo of keratosis pilaris of the thighs. What's that?
Yes, actually, that's quite common. And I think as an oncologist, you would probably call that a rash. We as a dermatologist would call it with this strange name, a keratosis pilaris, which is from the symptoms. If you feel the skin, it feels like a sandpaper. So, I mean, you have all the follicles, which are also probably hyperproliferative. And what you feel is, if you feel the skin, it's like a sandpaper. And it's not dangerous, it's harmless. It's also, you can treat it if the patient is not tolerating. Sometimes people have problems with their clothes that's irritating. And then actually, usually a mild ointment, it's very simple to treat.
So I guess one of the major issues with these BRAF inhibitors is secondary tumors.
Yes.
And you've published about this, and I'm still trying to figure out the biology of exactly how this happens.
Yes.
Maybe you can talk about the biology and clinically what you do to detect these and treat them.
Yes. Biologically, as far as we understand, is the following. We have an hyperactivation of the MAP kinase pathway. This pathway is hyperactivated because of the mutation of the BRAF V600E mutation and is actually firing down its signal pathway via MEK, ERK to the cell nucleus, and leading to increased proliferation. And what is going to happen if you shut down this constant firing by the mutant V600 by using a class 1 BRAF inhibitor like vimorafenib or dabrafenib? The alternative pathways, which are not using BRAF, but for example CRAF or ARAF, which are very similar and very close, they are hyperactivated, and that's a complicated situation. But by this bypassing signal pathway, other pathways are increased, which then lead to an activation and proliferation of pre-damaged cells. So if you have, for example, an alteration in the NRAS, which is also very close to this pathway, then these cells might start proliferating suddenly. And that has been shown in cell culture dishes and in animal models. And that's what you can see also if you study these newly appearing squamous cell carcinomas. If you analyze those, you find a very high frequency of RAS mutations in those. And we know that squamous cell carcinomas have anyhow a high frequency of NRAS mutations and HRAS mutations, and that has been described. So if there are pre-malignant cells already in the skin and you have this paradoxical activation of the pathway and bypassing this BRAF mutant activation, then you, by this paradoxical activation, lead to a proliferation of, for example, HRAS mutant premalignant cells, leading to an outgrowth of squamous cell carcinomas over the next 8 to 12 weeks, because that's the window usually where you would detect those changes.
And do you think that it's prudent to actually preemptively have the patient see a dermatologist to follow, or is it adequate just for an oncologist and the patient to keep an eye on this?
I think patients who have seen a lot of sun, who have a lot of UV damage, I think it would be a good idea to have those already been seen by a dermatologist and to see whether there are any pre-damaged sites which could be eliminated in order to prevent the occurrence of the squamous cell carcinomas or eliminate already pre-existing lesions. On the other hand, development of cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas is not a big deal in terms of it's not life-threatening. We have never seen any kind of progression of these diseases in terms of progression to a local regional disease or even a metastasis derived from them. So if you detect those lesions, a dermatologist or a surgeon can cut it out, and there is no reason to stop the treatment. Remove the cutaneous neoplasm and continue treatment with your BRAF inhibitor.
Now, you also mentioned the article something I haven't heard before, which is, I guess, the possibility that we might see other secondary cancers. You specifically referenced lung, colon, and pancreatic cancer. Has that been looked at, and is that just sort of a hypothesis, or do we have any data on it?
Okay. So we definitely have data on the appearance of squamous cell cancers of the skin. And we have also a new paper, which we have published last week in Journal of Clinical Oncology, on the appearance of new primary melanomas on the skin, which can be explained in a very similar way. So we believe that that's the same mechanism. In addition, there are some speculation that other cancers who are associated with RAS mutations, key RAS mutations, for example, could also be induced, and that would be pancreatic, lung, and colon cancers. On the other hand, none of these new cancers, which conceptually could be envisioned, have been described so far. So maybe there are some safety data on file within the companies, but I'm not aware of any published report that a new solid cancer has arisen upon BRAF inhibition.
So right now, in terms of clinical decision-making, assuming the patient has a BRAF mutation, how do you go about deciding whether or not you're going to use ipilimumab or vemurafenib, of the two available drugs?
I think that's a very good point. In the States, you are in the good position that you have, for first-line treatment, two options, ipilimumab and a BRAF inhibitor vemurafenib at the present time. Maybe later in the year, you will have also dabrafenib and trametinib, which will be the MEK inhibitor. But I think at the current state, I think also looking at the update which was presented on the BRIM3 study, comparing vemurafenib efficacy in comparison to DTIC, I would think patients with non-resectable stage 3C and M1A disease as well as M1B, there seems to be no difference in clinical activity between the BRAF inhibitor and DTIC. I think that could be a patient population which I think would be well suited also for ipilimumab first-line treatment. Because if those patients would progress, I think we have seen second and third line treatment with vemurafenib in the BRIM2 study, which has been published in the New England Journal just this February, we see that these patients still benefit after they have failed previous treatments. And we are not going to lose anything if we would not use a BRAF inhibitor in this situation. I think only patients with aggressive disease, M1C, are candidates for the BRAF inhibitors, and maybe the earlier stages with limited tumor load would be good candidates for immunomodulation by ipilimumab.
You also mentioned arthralgias, and you've published on that. What is seen with that clinically?
Yes, BRAF inhibitors, one of the side effects is pyrexia and some sort of inflammatory state, and this is very often seen by fever, pyrexia, and also arthralgia. And we have seen a couple of cases, and I know my colleagues have seen some of those cases as well, and we have made some very good experiences using COX inhibitors, trying to prevent as early as patients report on that. And in most cases, that's sufficient, and you even can keep patients on treatment. Sometimes it's necessary if the arthralgia is so limiting for daily activities to have a short pause of the treatment. And usually we try to restart after a couple of days with a full dose, but we have also a couple of patients where we have reduced the dose by 25% and they are doing fine.
Could you comment a little bit about the MEK inhibitors you mentioned in terms of the mechanism of action, the type of agents they are, and particularly, and you also get into this in your paper, the side effects and toxicities?
Yes. There are several MEK inhibitors in development, I would think at least 7, 8, 9, from different companies. And there are also class effects. And these class effects, for example, that you are getting an acne-like rash within 8 to 10 days in those patients, very similar to patients treated with EGFR antibody blockers. And this can be quite dramatic. So I think patients and physicians need to be prepared that this is going to happen. And patients need to know what to do in order to get prepared for that. So this is very common. I would think 80-90% of those patients will get a rash which is focused in the face. And this is also disturbing, obviously, for the patient, and you need to talk with the patient about that.
This is a TKI type, like the EGFR inhibitors?
Yes. It's very similar. It's very similar. And so the MEK inhibitors block the signal cascade of the MAP kinase pathway, a little bit downstream to the BRAF position. So the transition from the receptor outside cell surface is going via RAS and then the RAF molecules to the MEK molecule and then ERK and then to the nucleus. So it's a little bit downstream of the inhibition by the BRAF inhibitors. And interestingly, the side effects are completely different. We see, as I said, this rash, but we see also some blurring of the vision. I think that's one of the main issues for the patient, also important to know because it could harm patients, for example, for driving. Usually all these side effects are reversible and not a big issue. And also what we're seeing is some laboratory abnormalities, mainly CK elevations, which are usually asymptomatic. Whether this is relevant or not, we don't know yet. But this is what needs to be controlled for. So a patient who will be on MEK inhibitor needs to see an ophthalmologist. I think that's important also to prevent any kind of increased ocular pressure that is not being overseen. And I think a patient also needs to see, at least to have a check on his heart to see whether electric cardiogram is working properly.
Yeah, you've got a long list of ophthalmologic issues here, macular edema, retinal detachment, retinal vein occlusion.
Yeah, I mean, these are usually single cases, and we don't know whether this is really a problem. But what we see is that there are frequent problems around the eye, and that's the reason why these patients need to be monitored by an ophthalmologist in a regular fashion.
Where does high-dose interleukin fit in nowadays?
That's a good point. I mean, high-dose interleukin-2 is being only registered in the U.S. To be honest, I see this kind of treatment only in the hands of expert and specialized centers. And we have now other modes of modulating the immune system. I think ipilimumab has shown also to translate into long-term surviving patients. So in former times, IL-2 was the only immunological agent available, which had some evidence that there is a long-term survival benefit. Now I think we have ipilimumab around the corner, which is also approved, possibly giving the same benefit. And the new kids around the corner, like the PD-1 antibodies, I think have the same potential. I think this entire immunological modulation of metastatic melanoma will develop quite quickly over the next 5 years, including ipilimumab, PD-1 antibodies, PD ligand antibodies, and possibly even other molecules coming around. And not only as a single agent, I envision, and the discussant Jim Allison also discussed that in his presentation, that combination of these molecules would possibly even add up in their hoped long-term survival of those patients. I think one of the critical issues modulating the immune system with these blocking antibodies is, can we identify patients who really benefit? Because at the moment, for ipilimumab, we have to treat a significant number of patients before we see really one patient who is benefiting from the treatment in the long run. And I think we need better biomarkers for this kind of treatments to select our patients correctly. And I think that's the common theme also for high-dose IL-2. I think high-dose IL-2 has also the problem that we are not having great difficulties to select the best patient for this kind of treatment, and then we have a very toxic treatment. I think high-dose IL-2 will have a difficult time over the next 5 years when all these new antibodies modulating the immune system will be available.
Are there any markers for MEK inhibitors?
No. Except there are some experimental evidence that mutation of the BRAF molecule is also sensitizing the cells. So the first MEK inhibitor, trametinib, which is presented here at ASCO and showing PFS and overall survival benefit, has been tested in BRAF mutant melanoma. And there are some smaller studies presented at ASCO in NRAS mutant melanoma, showing also some clinical benefit. So obviously mutation in either BRAF or NRAS seem to be giving those cells an advantage to respond to MEK inhibitors.
What about all these new agents in terms of efficacy regarding brain mets?
Yes, I think one of the burning issues definitely is distant disease, particularly if it's metastasized to the brain, because the prognosis after spreading of melanoma to the brain is really desperate. On large cohorts we have analyzed over the last years, we know that the median overall survival time is in the range of 4 months for those patients. So what has been presented here at ASCO now are first clinical evidence on using BRAF inhibitors, dabrafenib, in patients with brain metastasis. Data were presented here on 172 patients with brain metastasis who had BRAF mutation. That's the largest study ever performed in melanoma brain metastasis so far, and the results are extremely positive in the sense of that we have response rates. Whether these patients have been pre-treated for the brain metastasis or not pre-treated for the brain metastasis, response rates range between 30% to 40%, and the disease control rate was almost 80%. And I think this is a major step forward, although the time to progression was in the range of only 4 months. And the overall survival time was, compared to at least the historical control, almost doubled, is now in the range of 33 weeks.
In lung cancer, we're starting to see investigators using EGFR TKIs for patients with EGFR mutations and brain mets before radiation therapy. Do you see that being done in melanoma with the BRAF inhibitors?
So that's still very early because the drugs are on the market only for a very short time, and efficacy data have only presented now at ASCO. So in those cohorts, as I said, there are some patients who had been treatment naive for the brain, so there was no whole brain radiation, no stereotactic radiation, not even neurosurgery being performed in those patients, around half of the patient population. And the other half of the patient population had some kind of pretreatment, as I had mentioned. There is obviously no real significant difference in the response rate and in the overall time to response and onset of response, as well as duration of response for both cohorts. So it's conceivable that if you have limited disease, use your standard techniques like gamma knife surgery or whatever to eliminate limited disease, and then subsequently, if you have a progress, using your BRAF inhibitor. But I think there will be study needed in order to test, for example, combination of radiation and BRAF inhibitors to see whether there is increased toxicity or possibly increased efficacy.
Anything new in terms of, you know, kind of seems less exciting nowadays, but chemotherapy for melanoma? At one point, we started to see some data with nab-paclitaxel. Anything new in that whole arena?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, is there any place for chemotherapy in melanoma, in metastatic melanoma? I definitely think none of these patients have been cured so far. I mean, sooner or later, these patients will progress, and we know from other targeted agents and other cancers, usually this time is rather short. So we know that progression occurs also on the BRAF inhibitors on average after half a year, and you need something else. I mean, you have ipilimumab now, but still, I think at that point, chemotherapy comes into play. And unfortunately, over the last 5 years, we have not seen any new developments being tested as a new concept treating patients with chemotherapy. The only exception is the nab-paclitaxel. And I think a phase 3 study has been performed to test this kind of principle in comparison to DTIC as a phase 3 study, registration study. And we are expecting to have these results end of the year. So we are waiting for maturing of the data. And I think end of the year we will have the data. And if that drug shows any kind of superiority against DTIC, it will be the new standard, I think, in treating patients with metastatic disease, either after failure of these new targeted agents and ipilimumab, or in patients who had BRAF wild type, because we have not talked about those patients so far. I think the overall survival gap between patients who have BRAF mutation, who are now being treated with BRAF inhibitors or in clinical studies with a combination, they will survive significantly longer than wild-type patients, and it will be of critical importance for those patients at the beginning of treating whether your tumor is BRAF mutant or not, because that's also of highly prognostic value for the patients.
What about trials in the adjuvant setting, looking at all these types of new strategies? Where are we with that?
Yes, I think current standard in adjuvant treatment is still interferon. I think we have experience with interferon for more than 20 years. We know that there are no discussion about the effect of interferons on relapse-free survival. This time is prolonged. I think most of the discussion we had around interferon was around the fact whether it would have any effect on overall survival. I think since we have now drugs with proven efficacy in stage 4 prolonging overall survival, I think the issue of are you capable in the adjuvant setting to prolong time to onset of stage 4 melanoma is becoming more relevant. So relapse-free survival is becoming a relevant endpoint. And for that, interferon has shown in several trials that it's effective. Nevertheless, all the drugs we have talked about are being tested or will be tested in the adjuvant setting. We have finished already a trial testing ipilimumab in stage 3, so in patients who had palpable lymph node metastasis after resection. Those patients got treated with ipilimumab, and the trial was closed for recruitment last May, and we expect to have results during the second half of next year. Whether ipilimumab has an impact on progression of those patients. In parallel, targeted agents like vemurafenib, dabrafenib, and trametinib are about to be tested in stage 3 disease as well. These trials are being very close to the start of all these trials, and then we need to have a certain recruitment time, which probably will last till end of next year. Then we have to wait for another 2 to 3 years to have the results, so I don't see any kind of results for targeted agents or combinations of those agents in the adjuvant arena over the next 3 years.
Any comments on pegylated interferon in the adjuvant setting?
I think interferon and pegylated interferon have shown, and I think in my view, which is an European view, pegylated interferon is as good as other kinds of giving interferon. I think toxicity and tolerability of pegylated interferon is definitely better than high-dose interferon, giving it for a whole year. And it's much more convenient for the patient. You just have to give it once a week. And if that's being done, for example, before the weekend, you can tailor it to your weekly activities quite conveniently. I think it's a perfect good alternative, and I think meta-analysis on interferon also suggests that dose is not as critical as we have thought maybe 15 years ago.
Maybe we can just briefly talk a little bit about basal cell, and specifically metastatic basal cell, which is pretty uncommon, but amazingly now we have an agent, I'll just call it Vismo because I'm not very good at pronouncing it.
Yeah, I think targeted therapy has not only arrived in melanoma, it has arrived also in other skin cancers. And I think the development of vismogenib is a perfect example that coming from a very rare disease like Gorlin-Gault's syndrome, which has been described already for years, it's a rare disease of the germline, which is associated with hundreds of basal cell carcinomas and several other deficiencies. But 15 years ago, it was shown that the sonic hedgehog pathway is critical in this disease. And based on that, inhibitors inhibiting the sonic hedgehog pathway have been used to treat basal cell carcinomas, and it worked. I mean, I think basal cell carcinomas is one of the most common dermatological diseases. Several hundred thousand are being diagnosed only in the US. We have around 2 to 3 million a year around the world. And usually there are several modes of dealing with it, from excision, Mohs surgery and others. And most of those will not bother the patient any longer. But there are maybe 1% to 2% of those who do advance because they are in an anatomically difficult location. They have some biological different properties. On those locally advanced basal cell carcinomas have the potential to penetrate into the bone or into the cartilage and have destructive potential. And if you wait long enough, there is also a chance that basal cell carcinomas do metastasize also like a solid tumor. And that's extremely rare. There are only 300 cases described in the literature. And I still remember when the company came up with the idea treating metastatic basal cell carcinoma, I said, I have never seen a metastatic basal cell carcinoma over 20 years. Why do you want to do a clinical trial on that? On the other hand, as soon as we had opened the clinical trial, and we have several clinical trials now over the last 3 years, I have seen patients with metastatic basal cell carcinomas coming out of the woods with metastasis into the brain and other organs. I think those patients have been, because there was no treatment option, sitting somewhere. And now, since those effective sonic hedgehog inhibitors are available, come out, very often they are old patients in the 80s. Very often there are some comorbidities associated with them. But these sonic hedgehog inhibitors like Vismo have the potential to block in a very similar way the pathway, downregulate tumor proliferation, and depending on the tumor load which is there, to clear also the lesions so that you possibly don't need any surgery any further.
These cases, are they usually people who've not been able to access medical care, or are some just biologically very aggressive?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think there is a large proportion of neglecting yourself, or, as I said, since it's an old person, relatives felt it's not worthwhile to go to the doctor any longer because she or he will die anyway, and then the person starts living longer than expected, and tumor grows and grows. And there are those cases, but there are also biologically definitely tumors which grow faster, who have a higher capacity to penetrate into the bone or the cartilage and cause trouble.
Now, this Vismo is a small molecule?
It's also a small molecule, yes.
Taken orally?
Yes.
And what's seen in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Yes, it's a pill, so it's easy to take. I think the main issue from the side effect perspective is that you have some hair loss. But what troubles patients most is actually that you're changing your taste, you get some metallic taste. And this is leading to, you know, changes in your appetite, some fatigue issues. So I think that's very important to talk with patients about and to find ways early on to not cause any kind of anorexia, because that also has been described over the time of treatment. And a second major point, in my view, is what is described as muscle cramps. So this pathway is also relevant for muscle development. It's expressed in this tissue. It's a class effect. You see that muscles are irritated and that there might be muscle cramps, which is disturbing for the patient.
What's seen in terms of duration of response?
Yeah, the duration of response for locally advanced, so deeply in bone and cartilage penetrating lesions, as well as for metastatic lesion, progression-free survival time is around 10 months. So I think that's quite impressive. And depending on the size and the tumor load, you are able to shrink tumors quite dramatically. In most cases with targeted agents, you are not getting complete responses, but you are capable to shrink the tumors. And I think in the daily practice, that may be quite relevant, because if you have a huge penetrating tumor at the very beginning, any kind of surgery would be destructive and disfiguring. But if you would be able to shrink the tumor and it could become amenable for surgery again, and you could remove the rest of the tumor more easily and also some reconstructive surgery in parallel, that concept has not been tested so far inside the clinical trials. But I think that is, in my view, the best use of this drug.